Hi folks, I'm Alan Watt and this is Cutting Through the Matrix on the 31st of May 2020. And I hope you're all just hanging on and hanging in, but not hanging yourselves, hopefully, during all this chaos caused by the reaction to a virus. And as time goes on, of course, we're watching more pandemonium being created as part of this ongoing revolution that we're living through. The revolution was written about at the United Nations. It was written about from the Rockefeller Foundation. And it's been written about too from the Club of Rome and all the and the World Economic Forum constantly telling us and telling us that we'd have to go into sustainability for a new world order. And by the way, the United Nations has come out with an article called the United Nations New World Order, for those that like to joke about it. But they say it themselves. They always say it themselves from the horses' mouths, just like George Bush Sr. and Jr. both said the same thing. But everyone else is taught to just laugh at anybody mentioning it. Isn't it strange how this idea of conspiracy theory works on those of low intellect? They always jump at, oh, it's a conspiracy theory, even though you can give them the exact same quotes from, and even the videos, in fact, from those who say it and bring it out at the very top. And presidents, for instance. But it doesn't matter, as I say, facts don't matter in the system we're going through right now. But we're living through it, and they keep telling us, look, you won't listen to us. You've got so many minutes to midnight to stop the world from just going into self-destruct with too many people, too many of you, actually. See, all of you, you know, the peasant class. And everybody below a baron and a sir and so on is basically a peasant. And that's most folk, even the folk who think they're middle class, because they can go down just as quickly, believe you me, if they're not necessary. And again, you got to look into the past to get to the present and into the future. And George Orwell, of course, summed that whole thing up in 1984. Because they controlled the past. And if you control the past, you can control the future and the present, in fact. In the present, you can rewrite the past if you want to as well, which they do all the time. We're living through this all. In fact, there's never been a time like right now with this COVID lockdown and the complete censoring across the whole internet and social media by the new information czars. Unelected czars and a totalitarian system, naturally, it really, really is. But you can watch articles disappearing in real time when you're looking them up, if you can even get to them, because the shadow ban and you time out and all that, try to get to different articles that have been there for years, and they just disappear eventually, rather quickly, in real time, as they go all out with this war on free speech and free thought and free exchange of ideas. You can only get their ideas that are authorized at the top from the czars and their teams, but not from anybody else, or even from yourself. I've looked up stuff I've said in the past myself. I can't find it either. But there you go. It's quite amazing, isn't it? The times we're living in. It doesn't surprise me, because I've been waiting for it for a long, long, long time. Because I did study, and I really did. I didn't, not like the person who copies my bio. I really did study from a very early age and went to the library and found the old books and so on. Excellent libraries they had in Britain, in Scotland, and especially in the old reference libraries. Even in school you could dig up some, because we didn't chuck the books out then. They didn't have what they call the weeding, the social librarian weeding that they have today, where they weed out books that are now politically incorrect. You had different versions of history that were more in tune with what really happened at the time when I was in school. And right down to money, it was fascinating when you're about 7 years old or six, and you start thumbing through a school textbook meant for young children, very young, about money and armies and empires, because empires just don't come out of nowhere. It's got to have structure and management and an organization to manage it all, right down to quartermasters and so on. that dealt with supplies for the armies and so on. And where did they get the money from? Well, they told you in the book, and it went right back into ancient Rome and before, and it was fascinating to see the peoples who went along with the armies and dished out the food and kept accounts, and they went back to the emperors in Rome and so on, or the Senate, to get all the money paid back to them. Nothing's changed. It's just astonishing. Life is really rather simple, because it all comes down to economics, eh? and we've been living in an economical system, like a monetary economic system, for an awful long time. So far removed from any natural little tribal collectivist society. The collectivist society they're trying to bring us in today is a global society, but it's a socialist type, run by really those who are the successors of Marxism, maybe the third or fourth generation of Marxists, and they call themselves progressives now, if you haven't figured it out. And they use all of the techniques that Marx talked about using, and then they were refined again by Trotsky, and then that with the revolutionaries in America too, like the Weather Underground, and so they further restructured how to have revolutions and fragmented revolutions within society of different groups all combating each other to get to a particular goal, and how you create it and use it. All that kind of stuff's going on right now to an amazing degree across the planet. And folk never figure out who's behind it. They've got little clues where you see certain peoples cropping up all over the place, just like now we do when you look at the CDC. And you can see Fauci at the CDC. You can see Fauci too at the Institute, of course, for infectious diseases and allergies and so on. NBC Fauci again dealing with the WHO, the WHO, and so on. It's the same names cropping up all over the place. And again, it's Fauci who decides what medications you're going to get. And he advocates who they're going to be. And there's definitely what you would call it, he's not impartial. He's not impartial enough to be advising what we should have, since he's too closely affiliated with these companies, these corporations, that only churn out the medications and the vaccines and so on. I mean, at one time we used to call these folk gangs. It's much better and pleasant term to use. It's very short, you know, gang. Quite easy to understand, and in the gang you'll have the leaders of one part of the gang, but specialised lieutenants that would deal with other facets, like for instance vaccinations and so on, and big pharma companies. And then other ones that would deal with the government. We call them fascism, really. When it's fascism running government, it's really making sure that governments and agencies work together with the government, technically to make everything to work together, to make it work. But in reality, it's to force it upon the public. That's what fascism really is, when governments are in bed with big private corporations and the money boys at the top that dish out imaginary money. It's not even just paper or plastic anymore. It's just blips on the screen. A good magic act, a really good magic act. But we're living through amazing times through magic, isn't it? Because most folk haven't a clue what's real anymore, what isn't real anymore. Let's get back to revolution, right? And the New World Order of the United Nations, and sustainability, and again the World Economic Forum. All these big groups all attend the World Economic Forum. All the corporations, all the top members of the WHO, the CDC, the Club of Rome, and every other group out there that runs their lives, and Rockefeller Foundation, and so on. They all go to this WEF, you see. And they decide, with the futurists, how they're going to run the next part of their agenda. Not our agenda, because we don't have one. We have to follow their agenda. It's forced upon us. And it's announced to the public, just like it comes down from heaven. Even the idea of the World Economic Forum in Switzerland, you almost endeavor. You always think of it in the mountains, you see. You get a picture in your mind of the mountains, and just like in ancient times and Sumer and so on, and they'd put food up into the caves and the hills and that, because that's where the gods lived, you see. and they put the food up there and ask for the blessings, and it's always up on high, something above you, you see. And but today you imagine it too, like the Ultima Thule, off the high Nordic mountains, you see, in Switzerland, and way up yonder they all meet on the top of the world, eh? The World Economic Forum. And the overlords, none of them are elected, of course, because they've conned the public that somehow they're a natural appendage to government. You know, they graft themselves on. But they go there and they decide your future. I'm always astounded how folk can say, we're democratic, we're progressive. Well, progressing towards what? Whose progression are you progressing towards? Because you certainly are not told, most folk aren't told about it. The leaders of all the radical groups are well paid and funded. I mean, they get salaries, as like CEOs of corporations, a lot of the leaders of these radical groups, you know. If you don't know that, they get lifelong pensions and everything. Incredibly well organized. And if you think they're not part of the Mossad, the CIA, MI6, you better think again, because this strange organization called the CIA has been running the world since the end of World War II, really, and overthrowing countries and nations and plundering countries too for the rich men in their own countries. This is how empires really work, you see. But yeah, back to Davos, and you're thinking about them, and they're way up there having their meeting, and they're having big, massive, it's incredible, never mind the money that gets them there, and the money, it's not meant for the average Joe, it costs a fortune to get a hotel for the night, or a room, or even a little slum for the night, I suppose. You maybe bribe the person to get a St. Bernard out the kennel, and then get in there for the night. But no, it's for the rich, you see, and they don't want the peasants around there. And but they decide what they're going to do in agreements, and they draft. And again, by the way, most of these big corporations have got their hands out to governments for handouts and public-private partnership deals, energy commissions, all these kind of things. And so here we are, the people who are going to pay for it all are the general public of the planet. We're not allowed to get, we can't get there, you see, and get a ticket to get in or in. But these people at the top that live off of us, like parasites at the top, with their big think tanks and their big bureaucracies, just like civil servants for each company, that's what they have, decide how we're going to live. And of course, they'd always make sure that we're going to be dependent on what they actually have and what they preside over, you see, whatever, like energy supplies and all that kind of stuff. And we're supposed to all follow along. And most folk do. They never think about it at all. They think it's somehow natural. You know. I mean, if you suddenly notice a third arm growing out your chest, would you think that was natural? Well, how come these organizations just appear, you know, and then you hear it repeated on the news, and you'll see important people there, and you think somehow it's quite natural that this new appendage to all is making decisions that we're all going to have to live by or die by, you see. And strangely enough, just like Bill Gates, see, and just like the Lucky Gene Club, I like to call it, because that's what they used to call themselves, the nickname for them, when they meet together, the eugenicists, the richest people and all that, and the influencers of society. Oprah was a member of it too. And the influence society, you see. They're the persuaders, you see. But here they are, you know, the same people are the WEF. And they're quite open about their agenda. Too many people. And so what we've got to do, and the UN repeats the exact same stuff, because it's one clique with a lot of faces, folks. Like the different departments, United Nations. It's the same group, really, with different faces. You know, forget Janus. You see, Janus is the old god idea, and much more than just that. Of the one who looks forward and rules in front of them and sees and rules, but also behind them, he's got another face looking backwards as well. If you can imagine just a circle of them, with all different kinds of names. Looking outwards and inwards, And you've got the WEF and the Club of Rome, and you've got all the different organizations and all the big foundations there. And you have also the big top corporations all around it as well. The education committees and the UNICEF and blah, 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 blah. This all, it's just a club with specialized branches, that song. But they all meet and they're all on board with the same. Too many people, too many of you. And they would like to bring down the population of the planet to fit their goals of a wonderful future for themselves and their own progeny, you see. Their progeny is worth it because they have better genes than you. And they know that. If you look into the eugenic societies and how they formulated the better types and the inferior types. And the better types, you can't just join their club. They're quite brazen about what it took to join their club. You had to prove that you and your mother and your father had at least seven generations before you of good breeding, you see, who'd always interbred with the better families, you know, and had the proper, and they kept on the straight and narrow. They didn't go into drugs or booze or whatever. They would kept an even keel in society, and they had their children, and they would run the militaries, they would run the armaments companies, they would run the big corporations, all that kind of stuff. But they'd always marry within their own groups, and they were very sticklers about it, keeping tabs on genealogies and the families. To see if there are any bad genes or, well, you know, seven generations ago, Uncle so-and-so was a, great-great Uncle so-and-so was a bit of a lush, and things like that, you see. And they literally talked about that. They actually talked about that in their little meetings, and their little tittle-tattle behind each other's backs, because there's always a bit of a rivalry amongst them at the top, you see. But they all knew each other's families' histories. Astonishing. That's how the British upper class were. And the British upper class often had kind of emigrated into the country and married very, very, very broken down lords and so on, who lost their money through gambling and because they were not fit really to run anything. But nothing's really changed. You see, that's how the eugenic societies were formed. And I've mentioned it before with the histories of Charles Darwin. And he was one of many, his family was one of many families that were already practicing specially selective breeding within certain families that they claimed, or they really thought, through their constant checking of genealogy, that they had a better chance of a more superior offspring than the general population that married it because they liked the shape of some girl's ankle, you know, back in those days. And so they deranged their marriages. Yeah. There's many ways to look at it, because psychopaths can also marry psychopaths or the offspring of psychopaths. And it's true, they've done studies on that too and found out that going way back, you could find that the really nobilities came out of warrior classes that were really families that started to slaughter families around about them. You had a big family, you see, and you start slaughtering, you take them over, and all the peasants underneath them then were yours. And you got a bigger base to draw an army from, and you'd build it up and build it up. But the leaders, you would marry some other psychopath's daughter, you see, another warlord's daughter from either your own country or a different country, and amalgamate, you see, that's how you the accumulated wealth and so on. It's quite an old history, but that's how it used to be for many, many centuries. And we saw it too going way back into the pharaohs, where they often married their sisters, for instance, to keep everything. You had the proper blood, right? So you didn't want to marry inferior blood. And so you called yourself a god, and you'd marry your sister, the goddess, and have children, little goddesses and gods and stuff. Maybe it's godlings, eh, for little ones. But anyway, it's interesting to see how it's always been much the same. And even when they tried to put a scientific spin on it, like they did with the Darwins, and the Darwins just married for generations into the Wedgwood family. They're well known for their ceramics and pottery and so on. But they kept marrying, and so much so that I think it was when Charles's wife died. He then married his wife's mother or sister or something. But they kept, all they did was marry into the same families over and over and over. And of course, then you end up with unfortunate traits as well that are very predictable. Because all of the Huxleys too, who were also related to the Darwins later on, you'd find they'd all have terrible headaches and things like that, and depressions. Even Julian Huxley used to have depressions, came on him. But they got it all too from Darwin's bulldog, and of course Thomas Huxley. He was called Darwin's bulldog. He took over when Darwin died and pushed the whole idea of eugenics and superior breeding and giving it a scientific slap instead of the usual blue blood stuff, you know, to make it more scientific. If you quote things in science or the terminology of science, it seems more real and more genuine, put it that way, credible. So that's what they use for it. So right down to the day, you're finding the same things going on. The same people, right? You're the same people with the same agendas that they had centuries ago, who now believe it's time to have the great leap forward and get rid of all the peasant stock that they don't need anymore. So much so, they say they could even recreate a peasant stock genetically if they really had to. It isn't just, you've heard about the arcs that they have, right? And back in the 90s, gave talks on this, about the arcs that they have. They have one in the States in Louisiana, and another couple inside the States, other ones across the world. But these scientists, and they have scientists in charge of them lifelong, these arcs. And it isn't just seed for plants that they have. They actually have the semen and the ovum of different animals, all animals and humans, by the way, in cold storage. And every so often, they take them out of cold storage and will bring and actually fertilize them and then insert them into other mammals. They have all this documentation. It's fascinating. And they can actually bring whatever mammal is to term by using a different kind of animal as a mother to bring it to term. And they've been awfully successful. And years ago, I put up links on the documentaries that were put out about them by themselves, because they did that back then. And they said it was for a great catastrophe, like an end-of-life extinction experience that could happen. And they gave all the different scenarios, like a nuclear war or again, a disease would wipe out most of humanity, where the elite would live underground and blah, 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 and survive. But then they could come out and then repopulate the planet, including a working class stock that they could basically create there from sperm and ovum that was frozen. Just astonishing what they've done to make sure that they can survive for themselves, you see. It doesn't matter if most of the people just perish. In fact, they'd be quite happy in this day and age if most folk perished. And they're rather outspoken these days about that. But now it's always put under sustainability. It's for the good of the planet, you know. And it's for good for the animals. Just too many folk competing with animals and yada, yada, yada. So it sounds, again, all scientific. It's almost for the betterment and the good of something, you see. Whatever they do to you, it's always for the good, the greater good. And they never come out and says, we just want to get rid of you, for goodness sake. So they couch it in nice, cosy documentaries and things like that. Nice, wonderful. We're here to help you. And bring on different university graduates or professors that dedicated their life to helping. You just don't realize that. No, it wasn't for the money, it wasn't for the power and all the prestige, and it wasn't so that they get picked for survival for themselves when the rest of us go down the tube. No. These professors, they come out openly now saying it's time that the people around 65 just died and took euthanasia. Like the professor in Australia, they trot him out every few years, you know. They give these talks on television, apparently. I've only seen clips that folks sent me. But he gets all the publicity he wants because he's a spokesperson for those at the top. And they do their best to persuade you. It's for the greater good, you know. that you should collect that pension. And you've had a good life, you know. You've watched lots of television. They gave you lots of good TV programs to watch most of your life. That's what you did with it. And then you emulate what you saw on TV. And if you didn't have any children, you were really good, you see. But even if you were very good, they still want you to just self-annihilate at the age of 65. Leave the pension money because the government then could use it for good scientific endeavours for the future of the planet and those that are chosen to live on it. So this is how it really is, folks. I'm using a bit of a satire to put it across, but the satire is completely loaded with the truth. You're so used to being talked to like a child. And you can present anything through a good documentary using psychologists and behavior. You can put something across in no time at all and have most of the folk having tears in their eyes. And at the end, they'll say, okay, yeah, you're right. Okay, we're going to sign on for elimination at 65. I'm not kidding you. It can be done. You have no idea the power of a television. And George Orwell talked about it too, you know, that the TV could convince people of anything and to do anything or behave in any way that they wanted them to. Yeah. It's been done. But the folk don't know. And so getting back to the third arm sticking out their chest, what's that thing called the World Economic Forum? Well, again, you don't vote for it. It is created itself. The rich folk of the earth create it for themselves. And you don't matter, you don't count, because these are the ones who are going to make the changes in the world. Not you, you little peasant, and all you do is change the channel on your TV. But these folk literally decide what you're going to get on TV, and what you're going to believe and not believe, and how you'll behave, and what's good behavior and what's bad behavior. And what they're going to teach the children. Yeah. Not to have any children either, you see. Good. Yeah. But you can, yeah, unfortunately, it's so true. You're so well understood, as I've said so many times, and studied more minutely than any animal or ant has been studied. The study's going on, even now under the COVID thing, when you look at the billions getting thrown at different endeavours of university psychological operations and so on, and studies and all kinds of things to do with us during this pandemic. It's just astronomical. It's amazing. It's amazing. Because, you see, that's how you rule the world, is by understanding the peasantry. If you get the peasants in a room and you walk the tiger into, they don't freak out right up naturally. That's a natural response, you see. But they find other ways of doing it that won't elicit the same kind of fear. They could train you. They go up and cuddle that tiger, you see, if they wanted to do that. They could do it. You've seen the people. I've done the articles years ago. There's a woman, and I think it was it Canada or was it Alaska, I can't remember. But she had her two children. She was a greenie, you know, into greenie, hugged the trees. And Disneyland makes you love all the animals, you see. And her daughter, when they saw a bear, her daughter ran to towards it. And the bear swiped her and killed her. And the son went to try to help the daughter. He got hit as well. And then a few days later, they talked to the mum. And she says, I don't want the bear to be put down, you know. She says, it's not the bear's fault and so on. And the saddest thing was she couldn't see it was her fault. Because you don't let children go and run towards and cuddle bears in the wild. Anyway, I mean, that's they get that from TV. They really think it's a cuddly Disney world out there. These animals, have you seen bears fighting each other? Whoa. You won't want to be around that. Each swipe could pretty well put a whole slash through a house in seconds. Just woof, 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 woof. They wouldn't even notice it, the bears. So you don't go and cuddle them, you know. They're wild animals. Leave them. Leave them as they are. And give them a good birth. They'll give you a good birth too in the wild. That's how you do it. But now you can convince the people of anything, and unfortunately it really does work with the people. They're almost ready to sacrifice them, the children and themselves, to the nice bears, you know. You can understand, don't look at any particular problem or event in one direction, unidirectional. Look at it from different angles, because there's many things you're seeing at the same time there. How did that mother allow the children to do it? Why did the mother allow them to even go and run towards it? What was the mother thinking? What was her impression of what a wild bear's like? Where did she get that impression? Huh? Now, if you pushed a child towards a bear and it got mangled, you'd be up in a charge. But to train children to run and want to cuddle bears in the wild from television, nobody gets up in a charge for that, do they? That's the power of persuasion, again, through very, very expert videography, coupled with the soothing voice. You always have these soothing voices talking over in the documentaries they churn out. Canada's quite amazing for the women who do these documentaries. You never see them, generally, but there's certain ones with a certain voice and accent they use. And Canada is famous for using them for 25, 30 years. And they talk in a certain, it's not a monotone, but it's lower than the average woman's voice. And they can talk at a very pace, like that, hypnotic. And a little bit of music at the back there to put you into the alpha state. And which is hypnotic, you see. And TV will do that for you, going to alpha state. And then the voice is just hypnotically paced and mentioning the dut and dut and dut and dut. And you're getting sucked into it. And with the music and the tempo of the music, which will vary according to the scene. And when they give you the nasty, nasty thing of a poor bear that's lost his home because someone's moved in that area or whatever, then the music will change and dun 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 to this man, dun 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 dun, you see, and then they'll show you a clear cut part of a forest from the 1950s, which they don't do anymore, but they'll show the same thing when they want to train the radicals, you know, a radical generation like the Antifa movement. That's what they brought up on in school, make sure they see that kind of, oh my god, there you go. It really works wonders, doesn't it? He does. You always create the society you want for the next 20 years. You start now for the ones you want in 20 years' time. They'll be young adults and fully trained, fully indoctrinated. They'll have a common opinion for every topic. They'll have the same uniform opinion because they've been trained that way. There's never been a time in history when you have so many people at the age of 20 all saying the same things, believing the same things. It's never been done to this extent before. Before they've tried it for revolutions, they know it works, and you train them for the Bolshevik revolution. You make things as bad as possible with wars and famine and so on to make it worse so the folk will revolt, and you train them that you're going to work for a better utopia for the future, and they jump on it. The young always fall for the same things, you see. They never realize that once the revolution's over, those who really wanted the revolution to occur go after the leaders and annihilate them. That's standard. For those, this is a little warning for those who are doing it right now. They don't realize this. But that always happens. And you find, too, that Bezmenov, who was the ex-Soviet spy that came out in the 70s and 80s and talked about it and the cultural espionage. It was cultural espionage. It was successful. That's all you had to do was destroy the culture. The Frankfurt School knew that too, but Bezmenov said that the leaders that agitate and do the agitprops and so on, and they do the organization for the riots and all that, they really think that it's going to be a wonderful system. But when they find out the conquerors don't give them the wonderful system, that there's a different agenda there, they start complaining, and so they get wiped out because they won't shut up. That always happens. But that's what we live in. It's a world of constant intrigue run by powerful institutions, well-funded institutions, so well-funded, in fact, that most folk are completely misled as to who runs it all. That's a beautiful trick of, say, the CIA. It has so many revolutionary forces across the world on the go, all the age groups too, that and always disguised under political reform parties or revolutionaries or whatever, that the folk never catch on to the true functions. Even the folk who participate and actually do the fighting never really catch on. And that's where you have the old movies and even modern ones about the disillusioned freedom fighter when they find out it's all bogus. Everything's run by the masters of disruption. Because that's how you have control, is by causing disruption. You guide the disruption. You cause it to happen. You guide the outcomes of where you want it to go, the thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. And you can't fail by doing things that way, you see. Can't fail. It's done all the time. But the beauty of it is that it's so well camouflaged that even those who participate never really catch on to the bitter end as to who's really behind it and what it's really for. And to get great change for those who rule the world already, you must always plan the change, manage all sides to force the change on them, and all combating forces too, and then bring them into the new system that you planned at the very first, because it wouldn't have happened by itself. Folk are quite happy generally by the way things are. Even the moan and the complain, they're generally quite happy the way things are. And you see it now with agenda for the whole 21st century, with its different parts, 2015, 2030, etc., different segments of it, where things must be accomplished in each segment throughout this century. They mean what they say. And you have to go back to the old idea of no private property. No private property. I used to get kind of excited when I realized that Freemasonry, for instance, the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry, and Albert Pike talked about it, it was the curse of private property. And then you found that Karl Marx, of course, wanted the abolition of private property and marriage as well. And so they give you what they'll call as a more watered down version. We'll just call it socialism, national socialism, which is just the same thing again. You know, it gets you it takes a longer trek to get there. That's what Stalin also said. That he said, "What is socialism? What is communism?" He says, "Communism is socialism in a hurry. Just a quick revolution, and then you've got it. Then you can call yourself socialist if you want to. You've had the revolution." Was a Fabian society set up in Britain and funded by the richest folk on the planets at the time, like the Astor families and others. They're all part of it, and Rothschilds, because they own all sides. You got to own all sides if you want conflicting parties that will fight and push and argue to get changes, because you plan the changes. And you get them to argue out in parliaments and so on, this party versus that party, and you bring the desired conclusion along, you see. That's how it's done. Folk never catch on to it at all. But the Fabian Society literally boasted, if you get the old books from it, when George Bernard Shaw and H.G. Wells were the top members at the time, amongst others, of course, they had lots of correspondence with the Soviet Union, the early Soviet Union too, and they boasted they had a direct line to the desk of Lenin and then Stalin, and then of course then Trotsky, and then they had a little tiff. You still see the old letters from Trotsky addressed to them if you bore to read through them. Most folk don't read this stuff, but it's interesting to see the slanging matches. We call it a slanging match, where they'd criticize each other because Trotsky wanted instant rebellion and stop this playing the political game to achieve your goals by the Fabian, meaning the slow technique. Have a revolution, but they wouldn't go along with it. They were tempted at times to try and go along with it, but they didn't think they'd get away with it at the time. And the public, they couldn't get the public ready for revolution so quickly. So they did the same with Germany, of course. The Germany, you find lots of articles put out by the top Soviets at the time, who before World War II and even up leading up to World War I, they hoped to bring Germany into a revolution for communism, as they were going to do with Russia, with the Bolsheviks. And they thought they'd be having a revolution. They tried a couple of ones which failed there, but when you read how they analysed the data when it all failed, they said that the German people, it says, even though they're mainly working class people, very robust and hard working people, they just wouldn't fall for this idea of a communist system. A lot of them were still religious, by the way, you know, in Germany. And so they couldn't get them to just overthrow their governments, and they really hated it when the Germans would take up arms when told to go and fight for the country. That they hated them for the working class for doing. I never forgave them for that. And of course, Britain also had little revolutions that they attempted at the time in London, and you can still see the old photographs of Winston Churchill in his big top hat at the time, with policemen standing with shotguns around a building near the quay in the Thames, where the communists had hoped to have revolution started, were holed up. But it's quite amazing when they're doing that, they always have the standbys, the trusty method of doing it, which is the Fabian technique of slow incremental changes until, after World War II. I mean, Britain went into World War II giving the excuse to the public, you know, because you always get excuses, never the truth, of why they were going to fight Germany. But they were going to fight, supposedly, to save their way of life and their culture and their traditions and everything, you know. And so they were going to fight National Socialism, which was Germany, the National Socialist Party. And at the end of World War II, supposedly the victors, they were worse off than Germany, in fact. Germany got on its feet far faster, too, with economic aid from all the countries. And through the United Nations and the World Bank, they got Germany on its feet much faster. But Britain emerged from World War II as a National Socialist country. The very opposite of what it was fighting initially. So you understand, you're taken for a ride when you lose your sensibilities and you start parroting propaganda. And you start believing in the propaganda. You've lost your sensibilities. You won't actually see what's really happening. And the folk don't see what's happening as they go through, let's save ourselves. They lose all sensibilities when it's panic mode, you know, whether it's a pandemic or it's a war. You're all going to die, give up your rights and freedoms, do what you're told, and starve yourselves through rationing and obey. And they all do it dutifully. They never fail. So Hitler mentioned that too, so did Stalin. And Stalin was more vocal about it, that the techniques work so well for terrorizing the public. Get them to obey you to save their lives, and then you do whatever you want with them. It never fails, but folk always forget. Most folk lose their sensibilities right off the bat. They really do. And then the Lambert, the Green Party, I've got an article somewhere, quite a few years ago, in Britain, where she said that she looks back with nostalgia at the way her parents and so on put up with World War II and the Blitz in London, and they seemed so happy and resolute to get through it, even though they were on terrible rationing and starvation. But everybody obeyed the law and they did what they were told, and that's what appeals to those in power, when you do what you're told and obey them and put up with all kinds of hardships which you shouldn't be putting up with in the first place. Nothing changes. And what's that got to do with anything today? Well, you're going through it again. If you really think this pandemic just came out of the blue, fine, you can toss about that up in the air and argue about it forever if you want to. But the preparations for it certainly did not. And you can't, I keep saying this, you know, in the 1990s, the project for a new American century, the PNAC group, that eventually got in with George Bush, you know, and in the 90s, when they met more informally, even though some of them were in governments at the time too, they wrote the list out, the list of countries they wanted to invade and take over and plunder across the Middle East and so on, in Asia. And we've been doing that ever since, actually. And they got little George Bush in there, and the same members, of course, and 9/11 happened. They even said it in their articles, they need something to get that. The first thing you must do is get public opinion on your side. You must get the support of the people if you want to go to war, you see. So they said that we need something on the scale of a Pearl Harbor event. Well, no one's going to complain about Pearl Harbor. Well, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Of course, there's lots of things about that, but regardless, they did attack it. And that's what you need to get to go to war, you see. And bingo, I mean, literally, within 2 years or 1 year, they got what they wanted. 9/11 happened. What luck for them, eh? They actually say to get all this agenda done, eh? This would you would need a Pearl Harbor event to galvanize the people to be behind you for war. And bing, they get it. They get it. And then all your freedoms get tossed, not just in the US, but across the planet. Everybody's in the same mode. Oh, we're all allies. Oh, let's all sign the same things in the law. Let's use high technology to censor speech and monitor the people. Let's build big, almost cities to collect all the data and for everybody's chit-chat, etc., like the NSA and all the other organizations they're using. I mean, and then you train the people not to mind it. And sure enough, eventually they get used to it. Do you ever wonder why folk put up with the Soviet Union for so long? They got used to it. We can get used to pretty well anything. You get used to it. Doesn't mean it's right or proper. And once you get, they know it too, that once you get, say, 20 years of constant surveillance and facial recognition and all thumbprints, iris scans, they can push it to the next step because they've all accepted it. It's normal. You normalize anything. It's a new normal. I came out with a new normal years ago. And here's another new normal that you're going through now because here's the second phase of it. And so at the World Economic Forum, you have all these big industries, the electronic companies, and all work with them. They're all part of, by the way, of the military-industrial complex, all these different ones that are going to churn out your bracelets and apps and so on, for monitoring you for COVID and all that. Can you get out your house? Can you not get out your house? You've got to get this app, yada, yada. These are the same people that, who are part of the, that these people are part of the military-industrial complex. Each corporation that you hear is a part of it. And so they get big money from the taxpayers again because you're in a fascist society, and then they make more chains for you, and you'll adapt into it as well. Well, I can't go. I have to go to that flight. I forgot to get my app upgraded for my immunity passport and blah, blah, blah. And that's what, that will be common phraseology given 3 years from now. Here's one example right here. One of many, actually. Just with the bracelets alone, never mind the apps that they have for your phones. And of course, everybody's going to run towards it. I could get the app for my phone and give it a snob appeal. Make give it more. What to buy this one? It's expensive. I mean, it's a better one than the commoner's one. Folk are really pretty dumb, you know. You only see it coming out in times like this, like these. And this one here is coronavirus monitoring bracelets flood the market. Ready to snitch on people who don't distance. Wow. There you go. And that's what they've even got them for factories, by the way, and adapting them so that they'll go off with alarms if you're closer than 6 feet away. Even I've got articles here today where in Britain, I think elsewhere, they're dropping it to maybe 3 feet's okay away, you know. Is it just the magic slide rule? It's all magic. It's nothing to do with reality or science. So anyway, here they go. It's the surveillance firms around the world are licking their lips at a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to cash in on the coronavirus by repositioning one of their most invasive products, the tracking bracelet. That's the one that Tam in Canada is pushing. Of course, you mentioned that years ago. Been interesting to find out how many at the top have got shares in the products as well, by the way. They'll be given shares, I'm sure, to promote them in their own countries. Body monitors are associated with criminality and guilt in the popular imagination. The accessories of Wall Street crooks under house arrest and menace to society, parolees, unlike smartphones, de facto tracking devices in their own right strapped on trackers are expressly designed to be attached to the body and exist solely to report the user's whereabouts and interactions to one or more third parties. They don't play podcasts or tell you how many steps you took that day to sweeten the surveillance. This is but a climate of perpetual bio-anxiety has paved the way for broader acceptance of carceral technologies, with a wave of companies trying to sell tracking accessories to business owners eager to reopen under the aegis of responsible social distancing and the governments hoping to keep a closer eye on people under quarantine. And it goes on and on. But that's just one example, and that's from Global Research. And it's a longer article, of course, but I know they're also putting into it, into them, more data. And of course, they report to you if you're out of... You see, they put you into a certain area, which, of course, all totalitarian systems do eventually. And, of course, under Agenda 21, they don't want you moving outside your area that you live in. Huh? Did you know that? I hope you know that. Under the agenda for the whole 21st century, they actually mentioned eventually they'll phase out all privately owned vehicles. And but you'll be locked down, basically, with or without pandemics, in your own little area. That's how. That's more tidy that way. If your masters like it to be tidy and efficient, you understand. And if you're taking time off to go holidaying across the countryside, that's awfully untidy. And you should do what you're told and be good and stay in your own little area where you're monitored and your little bracelet won't go off. But that's what I'll get. I mean, this stuff really is all for... This is never going to go away. I hope you understand this. They're licking their lips at the top. And just like the 9/11 with incredible surveillance laws that they just rammed down everybody's throats without asking, do you mind? It's never going to go away because it's so lucrative. We're slaves, you understand. We are slaves. And as far as those at the top, the WEF, the World Economic Forum, are concerned, and the Club of Rome, we're obsolete slaves. We really don't have any rights because they don't need us anymore. They're only suffering us. You know, we're in sufferance at the moment. That's how they put up with us. Not because they really want to. And they don't really need us so much now, you see. They really don't. And they planned the great leap forward into the future, into their modern utopia that they keep telling us all about. That's just for themselves, with a vastly reduced population, like the Georgia Guidestones prattle on about, and that people like, Jacques Cousteau is one, and David Attenborough, but Jacques Cousteau was awfully good about it. He said quite openly, when he, in between, cuddling his fish and everything, he mentioned that they'd have to kill off 140,000 people a day, every day, rapidly, over the normal death rate. To bring the population down over so many years to a more acceptable level. I guess to get more room for his fish and things, I suppose, you know. Yep. And they always give you these same characters. They're all eugenicists, you know. We look at the organisations they belong to. But they always put them in and getting the children to like them because the children follow the heroes that they see. And... that David Suzuki in Canada, who he said we were maggots, actually. We're just maggots living on the droppings of a higher of all maggots above us, you see. That's what he said, eh? And David Attenborough has been very blatant about it. They made him a sir for being so blatant about it, which tells you a lot right off the bat, too, of who runs the show at the top, and Prince Philip's organisations, of course. Eh? But... it's astonishing what we live in and how people hear everything that they should be wary of. They hear about it and should take action, but they don't. They think, well, they can't mean what they say. Do you understand that that happens before every terrible catastrophe in history? Oh, they wouldn't do that. Nobody would do that, you know. When you look at the Crusades were horrific, horrific ordeals for every side that took part in it. And yes, you had the Muslim invasions in Spain and so on. You got them driven back again and so on. But then you had them falling onto that thing and they go into the Holy Lands and really quell Muslims and so on and plunder, do a bit of plundering at the same time. It's always beneficial to those involved. But some of the cities that Christians were holed up in when they were conquered over in the Middle East, they would take the women and then behead everybody that was left. You know, like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people get beheaded, and that was, and the Christians did the same thing in some of the cities. They took over, and I guarantee you, when the cities surrendered eventually, the people would all be looking at each other, thinking, "What are they going to do? They're going to kill us?" No, they wouldn't do that. You know? They wouldn't do that. It's unthinkable that people would do that. And so you cling to that little bit of hope of, well, I wouldn't do that personally, so they won't do it either. Well, and of course they'll get slaughtered. How many times down through history do you think that's happened? Hmm? It always happens. Well, they never do that. Well, we're civilized now. Every generation down through centuries have said the same. Well, we're civilized now, you know, we're more civilized. No, no. It always happens. Do you know in Scotland? In Scotland, when they had the rebellion for Prince Charles, not the present Prince Charles, I'm talking about the guy who wasn't quite so deformed. He was young Charlie, and he led the rebellion, supposedly. They could have maybe even won it, they speculate too, because it got down to Derby, and London was evacuating when the armies went down there. But then they got bad news, and there's an awfully good spinner of tales sent out to deceive them and says, oh, the English army's arrived on the coast. They hadn't arrived on the coast, but they believed that and started retreating back up to Scotland. Well, that was decided by England, or London really, who ran everything, that they'd annihilate the Highlands. Absolutely annihilate them. And the troops they sent up there after the battle were really convicts. And murderers, but they were given permission to go slaughtering through all the Highlands. And they did. They wiped out thousands of families. Thousands of them. Now, that was an ancient history. Yeah? It wasn't that long just before the American Revolution, in fact. And it's happening in your own country, right? And I'm sure they're all saying the same thing, that it could never happen. They'd never do that. But they did. They did. And then for 100 years after that, they were deporting them off the land to Australia, Canada, and everywhere else. And for the males, especially, that were fighting age, they could always join the British military and go off and fight and win the wars for the City of London. Who ran everything, that's where all the money was involved. And the average English person was just the same, because they were just as basically in the dark about how things really ran as the peasants in Scotland. But London was the centre of all, very old centre indeed. But every down through the ages, that's how it is. Oh, they'd never do that now. They never do that now. And then again, as I say, when Britain had its empire on the go, you have to look at the Official Secrets Act. Every country uses it now. But Lord Kitchener, his record couldn't be opened for the general public to see for over 100 years. Now, he was the troubleshooter of the day for the empire, and he would cross Africa, North Africa, and he was sent into India and so on after rebellions, and he would just have them slaughtered. He would just use martial law. I think it was every fifth man, you know, in a village, whatever, just grab them or who they were and pull them out, and in front of the rest of them, shoot them, you kill them. And that was the lesson that you put out there. The war of terror didn't start with Lenin.
Question everything. Intelligent.